today. As America battles some of the most devastating wildland fires in living memory, what toll does it take on the firefighters on the front line?
And we want to turn now to the wildfire emergency in South Lake Tahoe, California. The Caldor Fire is threatening more than 30,000 homes and businesses as it rages towards the popular vacation destination.
This is the nightmare so many have feared. Thick forests are exploding in flames. Firefighters are making a desperate stand, trying to protect neighborhoods filled with log cabins.
Now we're taking on a lot of heat here.
The Caldor wildfire raging across California has destroyed hundreds of thousands of acres of land. And since mid-August, it had forced tens of thousands of people to leave their homes.
The fire has been burning more than 217,000 acres, an area larger than New York City. Fire officials say lighter winds are helping them to keep the fire at bay for now.
This is affecting people all over the country. For reporter Dahlia Singer, who lives in Denver, Colorado, the spread of wildfires has become an inescapable fact of life.
We're an urban area, and last summer and even fall, we were just getting impacted by the fires. I mean, the amount of smoke, we've all been waking up with scratchy eyes or coughing. It's become kind of a very dark humor game of you wake up and you're like, is it COVID or is it smoke?
This year, more than 40,000 wildland fires have been burning across the US. They've been seen as one of the most alarming indications of the urgency of the climate crisis, and they have pushed the country's firefighters to their limit.
I feel like you read so many stories about, you know, the houses that are lost and the communities that are devastated, which are so important. And you see video or images of the firefighters working, but you don't really hear about what the experience is like for the firefighters.
So Dahlia decided to write about it. As she started to dig into the research and talk to firefighters, she was staggered by what she heard. The punishing hours they work, the low pay, how common it was for them to suffer with depression, alcohol abuse, and post-traumatic stress disorder.
And so I thought it was important to finally kind of shine a light on the people who are protecting our landscapes and our homes and doing that work day after day for much longer seasons than they used to.
In this episode, we're going to introduce you to one of those firefighters. From The Guardian, I'm Nosheen Iqbal. Today in Focus, burnout in the American battle against wildfires. Before we start, I should say that there is some discussion of suicidal thoughts in this episode.
I am on my little piece of paradise in north central Washington, just a few miles south of the Canadian border. Currently, I'm looking west at the Cascade Mountain Range, and I can see a couple of fires off in the distance.
This is Lou. He's worked as a wildland firefighter on the west coast of the U.S. for more than 20 years.
So yeah, it's pretty rural. I don't have any Wi-Fi in this location. I do have a little cell service, which is awesome, but it's kind of infrequent. So that's how I'm coming to you today on my phone.
Well, I'm glad that we actually did get through to you today. And I guess now that we have, Lou, can you tell me a bit about yourself? What was it like where you grew up?
I grew up in Oroville, just a little bit north of here. And we had an apple orchard and a hay farm. And I was really, really blessed as a child, honestly, in a lot of ways. I grew up right on the lake. You know, I had my own little boat when I was 11. I spent all of my time, you know, fishing and water skiing and playing in the creek. And I was just pretty wild and free and independent, you know. I mean, it was great.
And so what made you want to become a firefighter?
Well, when I was about 5 years old, we had a ranch foreman named Glenn, and he was my hero for sure. He was just this big, bold, competent, capable guy, and he was just a giant teddy bear, and I loved him with all my heart. And he was also the volunteer fire department chief, and so we had a large fire here in the 80s, and I remember seeing this massive plume of smoke off in the distance, and he was kind of running around frantically trying to gather his stuff up, and he was going to respond to that fire, you know, and I just thought that was like the coolest thing ever, you know.
How old were you when you became a firefighter? What was your first job like?
Well, that was been 1997, and I was like 21 years old. You know, I was so excited. You know, I felt like a real grown up when I was like headed to my first day of work, you know, for the Forest Service. And I felt like I made it. You know, I had a 1-year-old son, and you know, I was really just doing everything I could to try and be a good dad and a good man. And so, you know, my first drive to my first job was a really powerful experience. I was really just on top of the world, felt great, so proud, you know.
How do you feel when you're out there? You know, what's your state of mind?
You know, I think before my, you know, stress injury, I would like to think that I was calm, you know. Most of my career was being responsible for initial attack. And, you know, when you are rolling up to a fire and the first one on scene, there's a lot of things to take into consideration. You know, there's the fire behavior itself and where it's located and what other resources are responding and how do you communicate with them and who needs to be told what and when and who's going to be in charge, you know, and like all of these things, you know, is there power lines? Are there people that need to be evacuated? You know, there's just like a jillion things that are being processed as you're approaching a fire at the same time, or at least, you know, in a rapid succession. And I think that's probably one of the things I loved about my job. I love the cerebral aspect of it, you know. So there's so much that goes into being a competent fireman and woman that it's just underknown about, I guess.
Dahlia, we've probably all seen by now some of the videos and photos from the wildfires that have spread across the US this year, from California, Oregon, Nevada, Washington State. Can you give us some context? How many wildfires happen in the US on average over a year?
So it's kind of crazy. The National Interagency Fire Center, which coordinates fire response all over the country, has documented an average of around 70,000 wildfires per year. Now, a lot of those are really small, but 70,000, which is just mind-boggling.
God, it's staggering to think about. What's actually causing them?
There's a lot of things that are causing both the amount of fire and how destructive these fires have been in recent years and why we're seeing them, you know, on the news all over the world. Some of that is historical. So we've suppressed fires for a very long time and kind of this fuel has built up on the ground. A lot of it, I guess, ties back to climate change as well. We're having drought conditions. We're having hotter weather. All of these things contribute to kind of creating a perfect storm for fires to occur. Obviously, fires are a natural thing. We need them to happen. They're just getting so big, and we're kind of impacting that cycle.
And I've read that the U.S. Drought Monitor has reported that fires are consuming an area of land the size of Washington, D.C. every 2 days. Is this a new norm?
Yeah. You know, last year, our fire season went into November, which is unheard of. So a lot of people who work in this field are starting to talk about fire years instead of fire seasons, that on average, you know, fire seasons are more than 70 days longer than they used to be. So, you know, that's an extra 2+ months that we're seeing active large fires that really need to be responded to by large crews.
The picture you paint is just so relentless. And obviously the firefighter seems so overworked with a job that comes with myriad dangers. How well paid is it?
It is not well paid. You know, entry-level firefighters for the Forest Service, their base salary is less than $14 an hour. So a lot of them work up to about 1,000 hours of overtime. And there is a temporary raise to $15 an hour for federal firefighters this season. But there is a shortage of firefighters. And, you know, the firefighters who are working, a lot of them, it's not surprising that they get just burned out in general, right? You're doing all this work and there's a lot of financial stress that comes with it, along with all of the other, you know, mental and physical strains of the job.
So, Lou, you joined the Wildland Fire Service in the late 90s and you stayed for more than 20 years. Obviously, it's not a regular 9-to-5, but what kept you going?
So we worked a lot of, you know, 36 and 48 hour shifts. And, you know, we didn't stop when we were tired. We stopped when we were done. And so that was part of the a lure also, you know. It's kind of what probably led us to feeling like maybe we were, you know, a little more immortal than the folks that lived in the valley. I don't know, you know, maybe that's just ego talking, but
what was the most difficult thing? I know that sounds odd because obviously the job is to fight a wall of fire, but what did you find the most challenging?
I think the most difficult thing for me, honestly, bar none, was missing a lot of like my son's firsts, you know, like I missed almost all of his birthdays because his birthday is in August. I missed soccer games and first dances and first dates. And so while I was trying to do what I thought I was supposed to do in order to be a good dad, you know, at the same time, I was very much neglecting my responsibilities there.
So how did you cope with the stress of the job?
You know, when I first started fighting fire, like stress was for those people in the city. Like we never associated anything that we were doing as being stressful. It was just what we were doing. You know, it's like a tribe, you know, it's an identity. Back then, you know, we drank to excess and we got very little sleep at times on our days off and, you know, work hard, play hard. And so, yeah, we did pretty much the opposite of everything that we should do to make our bodies and our minds resilient to stress, you know.
You spoke to Dahlia for the article that she's written for The Guardian, in which you talk about one particular incident when things seemed to go wrong. Could you describe what happened?
I think the big difference in that situation is that, you know, I screwed up. We were on a fire in Central Washington and was there in a leadership position. You know, fire behavior picked up pretty early that day and it kind of forced our plan to change. And my trainer suggested that we go for a drive and do some scouting. And I was like, all right, sounds good. I knew that everybody was accounted for. So I felt good, you know, leaving that location. And on our right was a kind of a, just a long line of flanking fire. And before we could get back to where we had just came from, that wall of flanking fire turned into like a 100-foot wall of head fire, and it overran the road in front of us that we had just come down. And so we had to back up and we actually ran into the ditch and got kind of stuck for a second. And then we made it back to the intersection. At one point, the road made a turn and we had a big wall of dark smoke laying across the road in front of us and fire on both sides of our windows. And we had to make a choice whether to abandon our vehicle and run or to try and drive through this wall of heavy smoke and hope that there was safety to be had on the other side. And that was what we ultimately opted to do. And, you know, I was pretty certain that that was the end of my days. You know, I was pretty dead in my head for sure.
So what happened to you and the way that you processed that afterwards?
Well, immediately afterwards, I was still pretty amped up from that experience and kind of went back to work that day. That night, you know, I laid in bed all night awake, and the next morning that I was so anxious. Honestly, at that point, all I wanted to do was to get to, you know, my wife and to get to somewhere else. You know, I just needed out of there. Like I couldn't even really concentrate on my job, and I was rattled, no doubt. I was pretty shook up.
Did you recognize that it was trauma at that point?
I maybe thought that it was traumatic, but I don't know that I thought of it as being like I was injured. As time went on, things definitely started to change for me. One of the biggest symptoms that I really experienced was insomnia. And it seemed just like every time that I got ordered up to go anywhere, I would not be able to sleep. It's like my brain was just on. It was stuck in flight, you know, or fight. And, you know, one time in Florida, I went like 5 nights in a row without sleep and ultimately took an Uber to the ER at 2 a.m. to try and get some help, you know. You know, my mind just started reacting to situations differently than it used to. And, you know, there was more anxiety associated with certain things than I had ever experienced before, you know, and then, you know, I went back to work and just still kicking that can down the road, trying to, you know, not sure of what was going on. And yeah, it took a while for me to reach out for some help.
There was a study done recently by researchers at Florida State University, which found that 55% of wildland firefighters reported feeling suicidal. And we should say that this is a small sample size and there's more research being done, but it can help us to understand what's going on. The Bureau of Land Management has also been tracking, and it's found that the number of wildland firefighters who have taken their own lives has risen in the past few years. What do you make of that?
I mean, it makes me super sad, right? This is, I have, for sure. And, you know, I lost my very best friend to sadness, if you will, also. So, yeah, it's a really hard thing, for sure. The numbers, I can't say that it honestly surprises me. I think there's a lot of things going on in the fire community. We typically have a lot of stress in our jobs and as a result encounter a lot of stress at home. I think that it's unfortunately also accompanied with, a lot of normalized alcohol consumption on some levels, which definitely doesn't lend well to mental wellness. I was definitely a part of that, it wasn't a problem, it was a lifestyle.
The job obviously had a big impact on your well-being. How do you think it changed you?
Trauma robs you of some things and just the ability to have hope, like to look forward to something. Like I just didn't want to do anything that I used to love to do. Like even on my days off and I had the time to take my boat out and go fishing, like I just didn't want to. I couldn't find my optimism, and I couldn't find my spark. And for me, that was really hard because it was one of the things I loved most about myself was my spark, and my that little glimmer in my eye, that slight hint of mischief, that's a big part of like who I am and what I love about me. And I felt like I lost that like really hard. And I knew that my presence was wearing on my wife. And I knew that my negativity was having an effect on people that were around me in general. And, I'm a fairly young guy, I'm 45 years old right now. And when you're looking out at the other half of your life with the idea that it's going to be this way for the next 40 years, it's really hard to want to be on board with that.
And you mentioned that you did actually have thoughts about taking your own life.
I think there's definitely been some points where if it hadn't been for the ones that I really love, I think I probably wouldn't, necessarily be here still. I just couldn't do that to some of the people that I really cared about. And then, when I lost my best friend, it made it even further from being an actual option. There were times when I was like, gosh, dang it, buddy. Like, why did you take that option away from me? Because I want an easy way out right now too, but I think that the message that I want to share with people around that is that those things can be so temporary. And our life changes so quickly sometimes, and it can go from bad to amazing. And I think we need to hang on to that hope. And I think that we need to know that there is help and there is support, and we need to lean on people that we trust. And there's options to help.
Is it accurate to say that in 2017, you were diagnosed with post-traumatic stress disorder?
Yeah.
What was it like to hear that for the first time?
I wept, nobody wants to hear a diagnosis like that, I guess. But at the same time, it was so better than not having one at all. And it gave me something that I could grab onto and learn about and try to treat, and try to learn as much as I could about how to live with it.
It's a really tough situation for you. And like you said, for your wife as well. How did she cope?
Yeah, I think that for a long time, my sadness was just kind of getting on her. She has the ability to create this amazing space around her, a mental space that's really positive and really beautiful. And when you're with somebody that's having a really difficult time doing that, it's taxing and it's exhausting, and they want to help and they don't know how, and everything they do seems to not work. And, ultimately between the two of us, we've decided to spend more time apart in an effort to give her the space that she needs to cultivate joy and a life that she really, really wants to live in. And I love her enough to spend less time with her so that she can be that way.
Does it feel like you've had to sacrifice, looking back now, quite a bit for this job?
Phew. I mean, that's a tough question. You know, I chose my job very consciously, and I loved my job more than anything in the whole world, aside from my family. And I think that they supported me doing what I loved and what I was good at. And even with the troubles that I've had, and, you know, as I've retired, like, I wouldn't trade any of it. Honestly, there's nothing else in this world that I would have rather done. And so if this is some of the consequences that I have to face as a result of not being well prepared for stress, then, so be it. And, you know, I'm still here.
I think Lou's experience is very common, and that's why I decided to focus on him for the story. You know, in his own words, he says that he was an average Joe firefighter. The day-to-day of doing this work, you end up, you know, being near a tree that is dead and breaks and falls right next to you. You see a lot of homes destroyed and, you know, people's dreams lost. And a lot of firefighters I've spoken to have been diagnosed with PTSD, certainly general, you know, anxiety, or dealing with knowing people who have died. You know, it all adds up. A lot of them talk about that you have this bucket and there's a certain point where it gets filled up and it's too full and you can't deal with it anymore. And you know, Lou had a specific day where his bucket overflowed, but all of them talk about that. Like, you have to do something to lessen that load.
And in this case, the trauma is really pronounced, isn't it? I mean, Lou's had to take early retirement because of his complex PTSD, and he's still only 45. How much support is there financially for him now?
You know, firefighters have access to a full retirement plan. And Lou, for the foreseeable future, is basically receiving 40% of that retirement to live on. But he's certainly not making enough to live on. And he lives in a very rural area in Washington, you know, and imagine if he lived in the city, it would be even more difficult. So he will eventually get his full retirement, but it's going to be more than a decade from now.
So as you've said, you've spoken to multiple firefighters and former firefighters. What sense have you got of the help that's available to them?
Firefighters really want to speak to other firefighters. They don't want to spend three sessions of therapy explaining how their job works or having the therapist not understand the day-to-day. They want to jump right in and talk to someone who understands. So there's something called stress first aid, which is basically a set of tools to help you recognize your own and other people's stress levels and maybe when they need certain resources or just need a little break or, you know, just need a chance to talk. And so they kind of redeveloped this program specifically for wildland firefighting. They changed the language. They made sure it fit the lifestyle and the kind of way that firefighters work.
Coming up, Lou confronts his trauma. Lou, how do you now deal with the effects of PTSD?
You know, I was very self-sabotaging for a whole bunch of my life. You know, I chewed tobacco and I smoked cigarettes and I drank alcohol and I ate crappy food and I didn't get enough sleep. And so pretty much the opposite of those things is kind of what I do now.
You come full circle.
Yeah, I have. You know, I'm like the wiser version of the punk I once was, you know. So now there is quinoa in my cupboards, and I run, you know, this week's been a big week for me. I've got about a 60-mile week going.
Whoa, hang on a second. A 60-mile week, I'm assuming this is a running thing.
Yeah, like, you know, over the week, I've gotten about 60 miles in. And
so you're fitter, happier, better, stronger. What's coming up for you next? Like, what are you going to be doing?
I don't know. I'm going to be loving with all of my heart. I'm going to probably try to you know, help my community in ways that I can. I still stay in touch with at least a dozen people on a regular basis as kind of like a peer supporter. I'm trying to say yes to things, you know, like I'm trying to say yes to things when they come up, if they feel right, like talking to you today. I mean, there's never in a million years that I thought I would be on a podcast talking about these things, but I, decided to say yes, because doing things that are hard is courageous.
Given everything you've gone through, Lou, I'm so glad that you did choose to speak to us, and it's really reassuring that you're in a much better place.
Thanks.
Thank you so much for your time.
You bet. I appreciate yours as well.
My thanks to Dahlia Singer and to Lou for speaking to me for this episode. Do read her article, Burning Out, The Silent Crisis Spreading Among Wildland Firefighters, at theguardian.com. If you have been affected by anything we've talked about in this episode, you can contact Samaritans on 116 123, or you can email joe@samaritans.org. That's it for today. This episode was produced by Hannah Moore. Sound design is by Rudy Zigadlo. The executive producers are Archie Bland and Phil Maynard. We'll be back tomorrow.